This is Eva Pusateri, Director of Communications and State Leadership Councils for the Policy Circle, and we welcome you to our pre-recorded conversation with co-founder Angela Brawley and Emilio Pacheco, President of the Liberty Fund, where they discuss the impact of socialism on Venezuela. After Emilio shares his story and the background on how socialism came to be, please continue listening for his explanation of what socialism is and how it works. Please note that the views expressed are solely those of Emilio Pacheco and do not reflect those of the Liberty Fund.
Hello, my name's Angela Brawley, and I'm one of the co-founders of the Policy Circle. Today, I am pleased to be able to have a conversation with Emilio Pacheco, the president and CEO of the Liberty Fund. Emilio was born and raised in Venezuela, and in our discussions today, we're going to discuss his upbringing, what's happened in Venezuela, and the broader topic of socialism. Emilio, you're the president and CEO of the Liberty Fund. Can you tell us what the Liberty Fund is?
Certainly, Angela, thank you for having me in this conversation. Liberty Fund is a private operating foundation, a private operating educational foundation, established in 1960 by an Indiana businessman by the name of Pierre F. Goodrich. And upon his death in 1973, he left most of his legacy to the Liberty Fund, and we perform a number of educational programs. For the most part, we do about 150 conferences all over the world on topics as varied as ancient Greek philosophy, modern banking theory, going through theory of antitrust, law and economics, opera, literature, and any subject that is concerned with the desire of individuals to be free and to live in a free society. We also publish books. We have about 420 titles that we print and distribute, and we also run around four websites of different kinds. So we have the Online Library of Liberty, the Library of Economics and Liberty, and Law and Liberty. We also have a smaller academic website dealing with political philosophy. So that's, and we've been in Indianapolis since, and now in Carmel, Indiana, of course, for all these years.
The Liberty Fund is an amazing place, and we're delighted to have you here today to talk to the members of the Policy Circle. So let's talk a little bit about your upbringing. You were born and raised in Venezuela, and I'd love for the members to hear some of your memories of early in life. What was Venezuela like when you were growing up and before Chavez?
Yeah, I was born in 1953. I was born in Caracas, and then my mother took me to her birth city, Maracaibo, where the oil industry was the main activity ever since 1922, when the first commercial oil well was drilled by then Royal Dutch Caribbean, and then became Shell Company. I grew up in this city, was the second city of Venezuela, went to school there, and then when it was time to go to college, I went to the capital, to Caracas, to live with my family there, with my father's family there, and I went to college there. It was a very interesting experience growing up in a city that had some of the most modern buildings, managerial practices, because it was dominated by the headquarters of the different oil companies. But at the same time, was a very traditional trading entrepot, had a very good influence of Germans at the time, and a big hinterland of cattle ranching and vegetable growing. Very rich, is the richest state still today of the all the states in Venezuela. The name is the state of Zulia. Was a small city, about 400,000 people. Was a very stable economy. Inflation was very low, never was more than 2% a year for very many years. And if you look at the economic record of the country between 1928, which is the for the first time, oil is superior to coffee as the main export of the country. Venezuela has the best performance, economic performance of any other country. It grew in per capita income to be the highest per capita income of the hemisphere, second to the United States, of course. It was when I was born, I think we were about 5 million of us living in a very extensive country, very mostly populated in the coasts, about three or four big cities. Agriculturally, not very well developed because oil had swallowed most of the economic activity. Caracas was a very, when I went to college there in 1970, Caracas was a very bustling city, very modern city. It had the best highways, but it had started to attract a lot of migrants from the countryside, and you started to see the development of a poverty belt that was always an eyesore, and economically and politically then will become very important in the progression or the decline of the political process in the country.
So before Chavez, what was the government of Venezuela?
So a sort of potted history of the 20th century. Venezuela's governed between 1904 and 1936 by two dictators. They were compadres, and one gave a coup to the other one. In 1936, for the first time, democratic political parties are legalized. And in 1947, there is an election. There is actually the first open election. The elected president, Rómulo Gallegos, didn't last very much, just months. He was demoted by or taken out by another military coup, was led by three generals. And that lasted until 1958. In 1958, the general was toppled by an alliance between part of the military and part of the political parties, basically three political parties. And in 1959 was the first democratic, fully democratic government. That lasted pretty much until 1998 when Chavez came to power.
So why did Chavez come to power in Venezuela?
There are many reasons to, and I always try to explain or try to make sure that we understand that Chavez was not a Martian. He was not an alien. They came from another planet. That in many ways you can see, and not just with hindsight, you can see in the years before he came to power, that the conditions were being created for the success of a populist leader like he was. The first thing that you have to note is that growth, that amazing record of sterling growth that Venezuela had for most of the 20th century, starts to reverse in 1970. And it's paradoxical because it's at the same time when oil prices in the world, especially after the Arab embargo, go up. And as the prices of oil go up, actually the economy starts to reverse. The numbers, which we will show the audience in our links, are startling. But after 1970, there are very few years of positive economic growth. And particularly productivity and oil income per capita continue to be lower even on the face of higher prices. So a democratic system that was based for the most part on a clientelar scheme by which the different parties distributed the largesse that they got from the oil income among their own partisans and among the people to buy the consent of the voters. As the economic development reverses, even as I said, on the face of higher oil prices, there is much less money to be distributed. And the second thing that happens is that corruption becomes rampant. The more money is controlled by the government, as the government gets the lion's share of the oil income, the more opportunities there are for corruption. By the time Chavez first comes into the scene in 1992, actually I happened to be by pure coincidence that night in Caracas, the night of the February of the coup, 4th of February of 1992, was the first time Chavez romped or appeared in the political scene with a failed coup attempt. And at the time, his popularity, as it started to grow, was of the champion of two things. A, he was the champion against corruption, and then he was going to be the man that was going to take the oil riches and will distribute it to the population. By the time the next election comes around, is 1998, oil prices are at the lowest they ever had been before. I think the Venezuelan barrel was selling at an average of about $8 something. The economic crisis is just dire. There has been a banking crisis. There's been the local currency has been devalued radically for the first time in the 20th century for about four or five times. So there is a real sense of crisis and a real sense that something had to be done. Chavez rides that wave, and he doesn't ride it as a socialist, by the way. He never presents himself originally as a socialist or as a Marxist. He presents himself as a man of the people, as a man that was going to be able to take the income of the oil and give it back to all the citizens.
So, Emilio, talk about the role of government then and the role of private industries. You've touched on a bit the oil industry specifically, but even before Chavez came into power, the government that preceded him had taken some of what we would think of as private industry within the government. So what was that? It was that nationalization of private industry?
Well, we need to go back to the Constitution of 1961, which again is sometimes people forget where things start and how things have happened before. And they tend to get one gets the idea that this political phenomena just come suddenly. The Constitution of 1961 had a section which was called the Economic Rights. And not unlike the enumerated rights of the American Constitution, it actually enumerated a number of economic rights having to do with private property, valuation when expropriated, or the clause of takings, government interventions in different elements of trade and contracts, labor laws and whatnot. As soon as that constitution was approved, the second measure that the Constituent Assembly took was to suspend all the economic guarantees, all the economic rights. In 1961, so the government, even as the Democratic government, when it started already wounded and with a conception of the economic life, which was, in the end, its own undoing. So why they suspended the economic individual guarantees? They did it because that would allow them to start intervening in labor laws, contracts, properties, etc. And, of course, they did it at a much smaller scale than what Chavez did. But the roots of the model by which you don't constitutionally guarantee private property and freedom of contract are in the at the very beginning of the democratic process in Venezuela. In many ways, as it always is the case, you always reap dust from mud that was created a long, long time ago. And that was, if you want, one of the original sins. Now, it took quite a while to take the economy and run it onto the ground. It took about, I would say, 15 years, 17 years. But it was the market for housing, for instance, in the city was almost non-existent because the regulations of on rentals were very, very strict. There were several monopolies in the production of sugar and other staples. And the government had, in many cases, the monopoly of licensing imports, which the government used, as you can imagine, to favor some people and to disfavor other people. So the tradition of an economy in which the state is heavily involved, making decisions, big and small, has a long history in Venezuela. And in many ways, what Chavez does, of course, with many other horrible things that he did, was to take that way of doing things and just add to that Cuban socialism.
So you were a young person. Was there freedom of speech in Venezuela?
Yes, there was.
There was. Yes, so there were there protests that were open?
Yes, there was. There was a lot of political activity. Perhaps the democracy had, as I say, had real serious troubles, but it was also a system that invested very heavily on education. So a lot of people were taken out of poverty, and there was a great mobility, social mobility.
And that was good for the people of Venezuela for some time period.
That's correct, because, again, as long as you have per capita income growing, everybody's happy. Because you don't have to take money from somebody to give it to another one because the whole pie is growing. But in 1970, that process started to get reversed. And that's when the political system starts to get gummed up and cannot react to that. The reactions actually are perhaps even more corruption, more poverty, more violence, and that is what explains Chavez actually wins his election, perhaps the only one election that he won, straight, with something like 55%, 56% of the vote. He had the support of all of the owners of the media, newspapers and televisions. He was applauded by most of the industrial associations and trade associations. So at the time, everybody thought, oh, this is great. This is going to be, finally we have somebody who is not corrupt. And
so there was hopefulness around Chavez.
A lot
but
of
then
hope.
Then what happened?
Well, started immediately trying to concentrate power. So the first thing he did, he called for a new constitution. And he summoned by a very biased method of electing a constituent assembly in which, with approximately 50% of the votes, he had about 94% of the seats in the constituent assembly. There were five opposition members in that assembly. Now, that constitution is very telling. It's the constitution of 1999, one that he had promised he would actually promote. The constitution, first and foremost, eliminates the Senate. So the legislative becomes a one chamber, basically destroys one of the checks and balances, and then he creates a very presidentialist a regime. And the one thing that the 1999 constitution did not allow, was re-election. And Chavez was never very happy with that. And later on, I believe 2005 or 6, he actually, 2007, he actually proposes a referendum to change the constitution to allow him to be reelected. That was the first time that Chavez lost an election since he had been elected in 1998. And in fact, the students who were the leaders of the opposition to Chavez then are the same people like Juan Guaido who are today the leaders of the opposition to Maduro. The same generation. They, at the time, they were university students. And Chavez, of course, I think it was 2 years later, called another referendum for the same thing, and this time manipulated, and he won.
Okay,
but
so
by
that...
by then he had completely closed all the opposition TV stations. There was only one which was neutral. He had hounded all the newspapers because the government controls the import of paper, and packed the Supreme Court justice. So,
at that point, the government has many controls, and it's grown quite large. And you had many members of your family were in the oil industry, and what happened to them and their careers?
Well, as you know, my brother Luis, was in the office of the president of PDVSA in 2002. He had made a very, very long career in the oil industry. And Chavez, in one fell swoop, fired about 20,000 employees, mostly professionals and executives of the oil industry. The alleged reason was that they did not have the interest of the people at heart. And what Chavez wanted was unimpeded access to the oil money.
That's the way he was going to get it.
That's right.
So it was about control.
It was about control. And again, the process by which he then eliminates any source of dissent or any potential competition is very steady. And is a recipe that has been followed later in Bolivia, was by Evo Morales, was followed by Correa in Ecuador, and certainly by Ortega in Nicaragua. And it's been always the same. You first win an election, then you call the, for the approval of a new constitution. The new constitution establishes eternal re-election. And from there, then, once you have all of those levers, there are no checks or balances for you.
So Chavez became a leader for life.
Correct.
And where was the role of the military in his administration? It sounds like he was peacefully elected originally.
Yes.
Did the military get engaged in his administration?
Military, first and last time, they got engaged in 2002. There was a massacre after a demonstration in Caracas. And the army asked for Chavez's resignation, and he did resign. They arrested him, and there was a very brief government that lasted about 3 days. And then another group of military brought him back. Now, after that, Chavez understood that he had to clean completely the army, which he did. And it is then that he goes to Fidel Castro and to the Cubans to be the people who help him, because he didn't trust his own military, of course.
And so the Cubans helped him.
So that's how the Cubans come for the first time in the country. They come as security consultants. Then, of course, big programs of exchange of oil for sports coaches, which, of course, we all know there are not sports coach or doctors. But the presence of the Cubans today in Venezuela is... like that of an army of occupation.
Wow.
I mean, if there is an imperialist force now at work there, it's not the United States, or it's actually Cuba.
Is that when Chavez started saying they were socialists?
That's correct. That's in 2005, and then he decides that he's been reading and reflecting about these things, and he's going to, his revolution is a socialist revolution and a Marxist revolution.
So what is socialism?
Well, socialism is a word that has very gradations and colors. But let's say that in its purest form, socialism is the control of all economic activity by government, by politicians. So you have two ways of making decisions in any society. You have either people who freely contract with each other, and they trade, and they have employment agreements, and they do what they want to do because they want to do it. Or you have an economy in which all the decisions are not made by the individuals, but they are made by bureaucrats who establish who can trade with whom, who can produce what in what conditions. Now, in between the what I would say the Cuban extreme, in which the economy is almost fully controlled by the political authorities, and what shall we say, Hong Kong or Switzerland or the United States, there are many, you know, middle stations. There are many gradations. There are more or less. We all live in what I would call hybrid economies. You know, there are vast parts of any economy in the United States or France or England which are under the control of government, and there are others that are not. And even those which are not are heavily subject to regulations.
So we're hearing that a lot today. Some politicians, some young people in our country are saying that we should adopt a version of socialism that is not necessarily your father's version of socialism. What do you think they mean by that version of socialism?
Well, I think they mean several things. One thing that you see is that the emphasis is on the what I would call the socialization of the benefits. That may be by redistribution or that may be through taxation. But the idea is that somehow there is a given pie, and all it's, what we need is to actually distribute it in a different manner. And what, of course, they again forget is that when what you do and how you distribute things actually immediately affects how you produced it. So the effects of any punitive system of redistribution will be, as it's been the case in any socialist country that has gone that way, is that production is reduced and reduced and reduced because nobody wants to produce or invest if the benefits of that are going to be taken away. So you get, of course, as I say, you get gradations of that. There is not a, never absolute. There is socialism in Switzerland, there is socialism in France and in Italy, but there are also great pockets of free enterprise, the same in the United States.
We hope you enjoyed listening to our conversation with Emilio Pacheco, President and CEO of the Liberty Fund. For more information, please visit the Policy Circle website at www.thepolicycircle.org, where you can read a series of four policy posts entitled A Closer Look, Socialism, using Venezuela as its case study. We will be hosting a live conversation call with Emilio Pacheco, Katya Rimkunis, Regional Deputy Director of Latin America and the Caribbean at the IRI, Juan Gonzalez, Associate VP at the Cohen Group and a Senior Fellow at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement, and Policy Circle co-founder Sylvie Legere on Tuesday, April 9th, 2019. This is Eva Pusateri with the Policy Circle, and we thank you for listening to this presentation.